I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday because it's about family and friends and food. Lots and lots of food. President Lincoln issued a proclamation in the middle of the Civil War, making a day for, quote, Thanksgiving and praise on the last Thursday in November a federal holiday. But if you think that shared meal between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag Indians in 1621 that we also commemorate on Thanksgiving represents a time of peace and cooperation and goodwill in colonial America, you would be wrong. Our guest David Silverman wants to correct that history. His new book, This Land Is Their Land, challenges the enduring myths about the interactions between the early settlers and Native people, which were really marked by violence and war and betrayal. He specializes in Native American, colonial American, and American racial history, is a professor at George Washington University, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And David Silverman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and thanks for writing this book.
Thank you for having me.
So what are you going to do this Thursday? How do you mark Thanksgiving?
I'm going to go to my parents' house. I'm going to gather together with family and friends, and I'm going to gorge myself on pie.
Like the rest of America, most of the rest of America.
Like most of the rest of America. I'm not opposed to the holiday in the least, just to attaching it to a false and, I think, ultimately damaging history.
You quote a Mashpee Wampanoag tribal chairman, a guy named Cedric Cromwell, in your book, and he says, the Thanksgiving holiday is a complicated day for our people. We are forever intertwined with the American Thanksgiving myth, however inaccurate it may be. Some of our people choose to observe this day as a day of mourning. Some choose to celebrate in a thoroughly American way. Many choose a different path, spending the day with family and friends, but acknowledging our unique history and connection to this day. I like the last part, because I do think that's something that we can all, in a sense, commemorate, which is to put this history in some kind of a context.
Right. Though Wampanoag people have been trying to tell us, really for hundreds of years, that the Thanksgiving myth is just that, a myth and not history. Nevertheless, they do appreciate that it's November is the one time a year when the public pays attention to them. And as soon as the holiday is over, that attention usually dissipates.
One of the Wampanoag says, and I thought it was so succinct, no thanks, no giving.
Right. I think the Wampanoags and Native people generally feel like they've given more than their fair share in the creation of this country.
How did you become interested in the Wampanoag in particular?
Well, I wrote a book back in 2005 focused on the Wampanoags of Martha's Vineyard. And what I was fundamentally interested in is how they managed to – that particular group of Wampanoags managed to avoid violence with their colonial neighbors and survive as a distinct community up to this very day. But in the course of interacting with modern Wampanoag people and talking about the project, what kept coming up – is the issue of Thanksgiving and how this holiday weighed around their necks like a millstone, and particularly how their children and they themselves, when they were children in school, felt alienated and lied to by authority figures like teachers and television producers and politicians who, in trafficking in the Thanksgiving myth, seemed to make light of their people's suffering while at the same time denying their existence as modern people.
Why has this myth endured? And it does, from the American point of view, I mean, it does give us this rather glossy view of our past.
Oh, glossy to be sure. And I think that's the primary reason that it's endured. What the myth does is it first and foremost sanitizes the history of colonial New England. It makes colonization, which, let's be clear, a colonization wherever it occurs around the globe at any point in history is always a bloody affair because indigenous people are not going to give up their sovereignty and their territory without a fight. But what the Thanksgiving myth does, it sanitizes the history of colonial New England, and then it takes that sanitized history and makes it stand as a symbol for all of colonial America. So it allows white Americans to feel good, to have clean consciences about the really terrible colonial history on which this nation is built. It also communicates a racial message of white proprietorship of the nation. It holds up the Pilgrims as Well, as the song My Country Tis of Thee puts it, it holds them up as my fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as a child, you know, who I'm not descended from the Pilgrims and I'm not descended from the Wampanoags, but it asks me to identify with the Pilgrims as we, as fellow white people, and gives them claim to the country. It makes it seem as if Native people consented to handing over their territory to these newcomers.
And you really write that nothing could be further from the truth. But you also say, in putting this history together, not an easy task, because there are not a lot of artifacts or written materials that we get from the Wampanoag. And you say, an imperfect history is better than no history at all.
Well, that's right. Look, the Wampanoags were not literate before the arrival of the English. Though, let me add, a number of Wampanoag people acquired literacy in their own indigenous language through missionary schools in the 17th century and left some of their own records behind. But the bulk of the documentary record was produced by the English. And, you know, the English were only concerned with a narrow slice of Wampanoag affairs: military matters, trade, and high diplomacy. They were only concerned with the activities of Wampanoag men, not Wampanoag women, and certainly not Wampanoag children or elders who weren't politically involved. So one gets a distorted view of Wampanoag activity and priorities through that documentary record. But that doesn't mean that Wampanoag voices and concerns aren't represented in that record. Indeed, one of the things I'm struck by as a researcher of this subject is how the Wampanoags managed to work through all of the layers of editorializing by the English to get their points across.
Hmm. Well, as you say, this was a complicated and sophisticated culture, a form of governance that called, is it sachem?
Sachemship.
Sachemship. Mm-hmm. Well, how did that work?
So Wampanoag communities had their own leaders. A sachem could be a male. Usually it was a male, but sometimes it was a female. And these individual communities called themselves sachemships. These individual sachemships would band together into larger confederacies that anthropologists call paramount sachemships. And yeah, basically what that means is these confederations of individual sachemships were led in international affairs, so intertribal affairs and trade and the like, by a single great sachem. And in the case of the myth of the first Thanksgiving, the Wampanoag paramount sachem is he's known to most of your listeners as Massasoit. That was actually just his title. His name was Usamequin.
Usamequin, who, as you write, was an incredible leader, but also a deal maker in many ways.
Well, that's right. He did reach out to the English of Plymouth, and he was taking a major gamble in doing so. For 100 years before the arrival of the Mayflower, so from the 1520s onward, the Wampanoags had suffered regular raids by European explorers, you know, sometimes were attacking them for their wealth, but oftentimes were taking them captive, sometimes selling them into slavery in Europe, and sometimes bringing them back to London for training as interpreters and guides for future voyages. For instance, that's why the interpreter Squanto, who's, you know, famous in the Thanksgiving myth,
sure,
could speak English at the early meeting of the English and the Wampanoags. And so, you know, the Wampanoags, understandably, were quite wary of Europeans and even hostile towards them. But Usamequin felt that reaching out to the English was a gamble worth taking because his people had suffered a terrible epidemic just before the arrival of the Mayflower. And now, as in their weakness, they were being attacked by their Narragansett rivals to the west who wanted to subject them to tributary status.
In fact, this was a terrible epidemic. It lasted for several years from 1616 to 1619 and decimated, you know, many families, many communities.
Well, that's right. And we don't know exactly the extent of Wampanoag depopulation. What we do know is that several communities were wiped out entirely. And interestingly enough, for the Thanksgiving story, The community of Patuxet, from which Squanto hailed, was indeed wiped out.
Wow.
And that's precisely where the English founded Plymouth, in this depopulated community setting.
Well, let's talk about what happened in 1620, the thing that we call Thanksgiving. As you write about it, it seems like a series of, if not misunderstandings, mistakes, or things that just sort of happened because they happened.
Well, sure. So, look, the English weren't even heading for New England in the first place. They intended
this
to settle.
Mayflower, yeah.
That's correct. The Mayflower English were heading for the Hudson River, and circumstances forced them to land off the New England coast. Initially, they probed Cape Cod, but Wampanoags, who had an experience, had a long history of fending off European raiders, fought them off and forced them to abandon that site. So they move up the coast to that depopulated site of Patuxet.
And that first winter for the pilgrims on the Mayflower was a difficult time for them. I mean, they were really facing starvation.
They were. They lost half their numbers in a matter of months. And their numbers weren't great to begin with. I think that's actually important to emphasize here.
How many?
There's only 50 of them left by March when Usamequin reaches out to them, which means that the Wampanoags, even after suffering the epidemic, outnumber these English by a factor of probably 20. So the Wampanoags are easily the dominant party on the ground. This is not a meeting of equals.
So that fateful meal that they had together, what actually happened then?
In March of 1621, Usamequin reaches out to the English and negotiates effectively a mutual defense pact and trade agreement with them. From that point moving forward over the next several months, the Wampanoags offer the English protection because some Wampanoags are hostile to the colony and the Narragansetts were hostile to the colony. So without Usamequin's protection, the colony would have been destroyed by its native enemies. The Wampanoags teach the English how to plant the crops that thrive in this area. The English didn't plant maize before this time. Oh, the Wampanoags teach them how to do that. They teach these colonists, most of whom were tailors and
nothing about agriculture.
They had never done this kind of work before. They taught them how to raise crops. They taught them where to fish. They taught them how to harvest shellfish. So that by the time we get to the fall of 1621, the English feel like they might actually make it another winter. And so they decide they're going to have a celebration. It was not a Thanksgiving, even by the English standard. English Thanksgivings were fast days. They were days in which the people would gather together in church. They would fast and they would reflect on their need for God's assistance to make it in this world.
Hold on to that thought, only
sure,
because we're taking a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. David Silverman is our guest. His book is This Land Is Their Land. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with David Silverman. He's a professor of history at George Washington University and specializes in Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history. We're talking about his new book. It's called This Land Is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. So we were talking about that meal that the pilgrims and the Wampanoag had together.
Right.
Help us sort of fill in some of this history here.
So the English want to celebrate a successful harvest. And
they had one.
And they did. And so, you know, they decide they're going to have a feast. They're going to let down their guard for a few days, drink a little bit, engage in some rough sport. And they start firing off guns, probably at target practice. Well, the Wampanoags hear the gunfire and assume that the colony is under attack. Remember, the two peoples had a mutual defense pact. So Usamequin, the sachem, and 90 of his armed men show up at the edge of Plymouth Colony to help. As you might imagine, the English are quite startled by the sudden arrival of an armed band of Wampanoags.
And as you say, about 100 of them, right?
There's 90. 90 of them, which, you know, outnumbers the total population of Plymouth by 40 people. Keep in mind, you know, half of Plymouth Colony is made up of women and children and the elderly. So this would not have been a fair fight. And in any other colonial setting, this kind of tense encounter would have produced a slaughter, it is safe to say. But the relationship that the two peoples had formed over the previous 6 months allowed everybody to exercise a degree of restraint, and the English conceded to the Wampanoags staying. And so the two peoples feasted together over the next few days. The Wampanoags contributed venison to the feast. And that was it. Mm-hmm. So effectively, what you have is a harvest festival that became a state dinner. It wasn't a Thanksgiving by Puritan English standards. And, you know, let's also keep in mind, as we're considering the misnomer of the first Thanksgiving, the Wampanoags had been giving thanks in various ritual settings since time immemorial.
But was this an exception then in this history between these two groups?
Yes, it was an exception. So the Wampanoags would have liked interactions like this to have become a regular aspect of their alliance with the English. Indeed, the way the Wampanoags conceived of alliances was that it would include the people engaged in mutual visiting, trade, and even intermarriage. The English did not want the alliance to work that way. They saw it as an agreement between leaders, and they did not want Wampanoags stopping by their settlement on a casual basis. Indeed, they saw that as a defensive issue.
They didn't want intermarriage, for instance. I mean, was that part
they did
of-
to marry anyone who wasn't Christian would have been completely out of the question. Strikingly, though, even when the Wampanoags began adopting Christianity in the mid 17th century, there are no English Wampanoag marriages to speak of.
You write, the Thanksgiving myth promotes the idea that this event involved Indians gifting their country bloodlessly to Europeans and their descendants to launch the United States as a great Christian, democratic, family-centered nation blessed by God.
That's correct. And that is not what this alliance meant to the Wampanoags. Their intent was to absorb the English into their society, not to grant their territory and sovereignty to the English. Mm-hmm. And so as you would expect, and I think as any thoughtful adult will readily acknowledge when you push him or her on the issue, holding up a shared meal as a symbol of Indian colonial relations, and even as specifically English Wampanoag relations, is an utter whitewash. This relationship goes sour very, very quickly because the colonists engage in aggressive and ultimately underhanded expansion.
In fact, you write that they had such different views of land that for the Wampanoag, it was sort of this idea of shared land. They were, you know, they were moving around. So the notion that you would stay put and have a plot of land was a very different concept to them.
Well, it's not that the Wampanoags were itinerant. They weren't. They weren't nomadic people. They had stable territories, but they moved seasonally within those territories to various resource bases. What they expected is that the English were buying into their society. So yeah, they'd sell land to the English and they would say, oh yeah, you can plant on this land, you can build houses on this land. But the expectation, their expectation, was that the English would accede to Wampanoag rules, to Wampanoag authority, and certainly not that they would try to subjugate Wampanoag people to English law. The English have a very different view. They contended that as civilized people, as they saw themselves, as Christian people, when they bought land from people that they considered to be pagan savages, that land passed out from native society into English jurisdiction. an English jurisdiction operated according to very different rules than Wampanoag jurisdiction.
And the leader of the Wampanoag, I mean, I think his gravestone talks about something like 54 years of peace. So there was, I guess, relative peace, but then he dies.
Relative peace. And let me emphasize relative. There are regular war scares between the English and the Wampanoags, almost from the very beginning of their alliance. But particularly after the death of Usamequin in 1660, he's doing a lot to hold these tensions in check. When he dies, his sons pick up the mantle of Wampanoag resistance to colonization. Because as they say, if we don't act now, they're going to rob us of everything, including perhaps our freedom and our lives. And they were right.
And that leads to a war, King Philip's War.
One of the worst wars in colonial American history, which is saying an awful lot.
Meaning what? Worse in just in sheer violence, loss?
Sure. So, well, this is a war in which is originally between the Wampanoags and Plymouth and quickly spirals out into a general regional war in which the Wampanoags have allies in the form of their former Narragansett rivals, the Nipmucks, Pocumtucks and Sokokies, and all of the English colonies band together and also draw on the support of some native people, Mohegans, Pequots, and even Christian Wampanoags. In the early stages of this war, the resistance fighters get the best of it. And over the course of the war, they take the lives of upwards of 3,000 Englishmen.
Wow.
They destroy 16 colonial towns.
Wow.
They slaughter upwards of 800 head of cattle. But when the war ends, the English are triumphant, and they decimate the warring Wampanoags, the Narragansetts, the Nipmucks, and others. They kill thousands of native people. They sell an estimated 2,000 into slavery and seize the vast majority of native land in southern New England and subject the survivors to what can only be called third-class status.
And I do want to get to that, but they also – what they do to Pametacom is they not only kill him, but they put his head on a spike outside of Plymouth as a kind of commemoration, right? Or a message, a warning.
Right. They dismember his entire body and send the body parts to various parts of English dominions. And right there on the very site where Pametacom's father, Usamequin, had feasted and allied with the pilgrims, the second generation of English pike Pametacom's head outside the town
gate. Was that unusual to do something like that?
No, not at all. And they leave it there to rot for 20 years. The geography of colonial America is littered with human body parts. And one of the ways that race is created in colonial America is that as time moves forward, the only rotting body parts that one would find at ports or crossroads were those of indigenous people and black people.
And just left to rot? I mean, just left by on a dock or by the side of the road or just hanging somewhere?
Usually where boats landed or where roads crossed. And these messages were designed to terrorize people into subservience.
Let me just reintroduce you and remind our listeners what we're talking about. Our guest is David Silverman. He's a historian, teaches at George Washington University. He's got a new book. It's called This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving, talking about this history as a kind of a corrective as we think about Thanksgiving, mark the federal holiday. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. As you mentioned, after, I guess, the Wampanoag and I guess other Indian tribes are defeated, they become servants or slaves even to the pilgrims who are living in this part of America.
That's right. And the cruel irony of it is that the vast majority of Wampanoags who survived this war descended from those who sided with the English in the war against their tribesmen. Some of them also had switched sides late in the war. But for them, King Philip's War is just the first stage in a centuries-long battle to defend their sovereignty and their peoplehood. And what the English do is they effectively drive these people into debt peonage. in which, you know, Wampanoag people are effectively beholden to English merchants and other creditors. And then whether through informal agreements or through the courts ordering it, Wampanoag adults have to indenture themselves out as servants to English householders, whaling merchants, farmers and the like. And then very often they have to indenture out their children.
Yeah.
And they lose control over the raising of their own kids to the point that, you know, by the mid-1800s, the Wampanoag language is on unstable ground. I mean, it's close to what we would characterize as dying, but Wampanoags call sleeping because they have revived it in modern times. I think it's a powerful commentary on how pervasive this system of debt peonage was.
In fact, you quote a missionary, a guy named Gideon Hawley, and you write he recalled that when he first arrived at his missionary post in Mashpee, there's a Mashpee, Massachusetts, this is in 1757, he was shocked to discover that, and this is quoting Gideon Hawley, every Indian had his master. Their children were sold or bound as security for the payment of their father's debts as soon as they were 7 or 8 years old, which two justices of the peace, with the consent of the parents, was easily obtained, were authorized to do at the desire of their creditors. These Indians and their children were transferred from one to another master like slaves.
That's right. And
horrifying.
It is. And, you know, look, I think one of the aspects of colonial American history that most of your listeners will be utterly unaware of is how pervasive Indian slavery and then Indian servitude was in colonial America. You know, right now, our best estimates are that between 3 and 5 million indigenous people suffered slavery in the Western Hemisphere during the colonial period. So that's about 40% of the overall volume of the transatlantic African slave trade. And that doesn't include those who were subject to what we might call here judicial slavery, right, where the courts and creditors forced Native people into servant contracts that could go on for years and decades and even several generations at a time. Let's keep in mind, too, these Wampanoags not only descended from Wampanoags who sided with the English during King Philip's War, these Wampanoags were all Christian.
Right.
So, you know, this is not just racial. This is just racial exploitation, and the limits of Christian fellowship is part of what's defining race in this context.
Did the Wampanoag Christians think that their Christianity might protect them, might give them some rights?
It did. And they were right in that respect, though, you know, it protected them on a sliding scale. All the Wampanoags who survived to this day, you know, there are federally recognized tribes in the communities of Mashpee on Cape Cod and Aquinnah on Martha's Vineyard, descend from Native communities that adopted Christianity early and then used that status as leverage to protect some, far from all, but some of their land.
I remember going to Monticello a couple of years ago, and clearly there is a struggle to how to tell the story of slavery and Thomas Jefferson. If you go to Plymouth today, how is the story of the Wampanoag told?
Fortunately, Wampanoag people have the power to tell their own story there. There's a Plymouth colony site in which everyone is English, and the historical interpreters are in 1620s mode. They pretend they don't know what year it is. But there's also a Wampanoag village as part of – or home site, as they call it, as part of the museum. And it's run by Wampanoag staff who are in period costume but speak – as if it's 2019. And part of what they want to do is shed light on the actual history of their people, but also to emphasize to visitors that they are very much here today, living in distinct and sovereign Wampanoag communities.
You mentioned their language kind of went to sleep, to use their words.
That's right.
It's making a comeback. There are people that speak Wampanoag?
That's correct. This is one – people will be talking about this development long after all of us are gone. I think it's unparalleled in world history. So the Puritans placed a heavy emphasis on every Christian's ability to read the Bible in his or her vernacular language. So when they started evangelizing Wampanoag people in the 1640s, putting the Wampanoag's language to print was part of their mission. Wampanoag people very quickly picked up on this technology, realized the power of it within the colonial system, and became teachers to their own people. Mm-hmm. It's not just the English teaching Wampanoags, it's Wampanoags teaching Wampanoags. And so what that results in is the first Bible ever printed in North America. It's in the Wampanoag language. Dozens of religious tracts, sermons and the like, printed in Wampanoag. Wampanoags recording their own land deeds and baptismal records and death records. And so what that's allowed the Wampanoags today to do is to draw on this incredibly robust source of documentation to gather together vocabulary lists and grammatical patterns, and then by cross-comparing what they find in those documents with other living Algonquian languages. Wampanoag is an Algonquian language. Mm-hmm. They've been able to put the language back together, and they now have immersion schools for their young people. It's utterly remarkable.
And immersion schools in where the Wampanoag now live?
That's correct, in Mashpee and in Aquinnah. Mm-hmm. And Mashpee High School is now teaching Wampanoag language classes so that young people who have graduated from these immersion schools can keep up with their Wampanoag language studies.
And you're saying this is really unusual in modern times to have a language that nearly disappeared to come back.
I don't know of another case like it. There might be some, but I'm unaware of them.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, David Silverman is our guest. He is a professor of history at George Washington University, and he specializes in Native American, colonial American, and American racial history. And he's got a brand new book. It's called This Land Is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. And we've been talking about what this history tells us about some of the early contacts between the Wampanoag and the Pilgrims, and how we should think about some of this history as we think about Thursday, Thanksgiving here in America. You can join the conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We want to know how you think about this history, how we should teach it, and talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowing, talking with historian David Silverman about Thanksgiving, some of our early colonial history when the Wampanoags and the colonists in what is now Massachusetts had a meal together, how this has created a kind of myth around Thanksgiving. For the Wampanoag, Thanksgiving is often called a day of mourning. One leader has said recently, no thanks and no giving. That tells us a little bit about, I think, the humor that you have also unearthed among the Wampanoag. You say there's a Wampanoag joke that goes like this: good thing for the English, or we'd all be speaking Narragansett right now. I love that. I thought it was extremely funny, but also very revealing.
It is revealing. And it's revealing because most Indian colonial relations pivoted on intertribal relations. So that the way that particular Native American groups interacted with Europeans depended on how those interactions would affect the intertribal and intra-tribal balance of power. And part of what the joke is exposing is that Native people's short-term priorities sometimes blinded them to the long-term risk that faced all of them in the form of these European colonists.
You also write about, and this is not long after the Pilgrims arrive on the Mayflower, that there are Wampanoag that go to Harvard University, for instance.
Well, that's right. I should emphasize to your readers that Harvard's charter requires it to educate Native American youth, and it hasn't always consistently followed those guidelines. But in the 17th century, its leadership took that responsibility quite seriously, and Wampanoags took the opportunity quite seriously as well. And so some of their young men who had managed to work their way up through these mission schools then went on to Harvard for, you know, the curriculum of Latin and Greek and Hebrew and theology and the like. And they made personal alliances with high-status English colonists and expected to use that education for the benefit of their people.
Were they able to do that?
Unfortunately, the one Wampanoag who graduated died an early death, and another Wampanoag who was about to graduate also died an early death. And King Philip's War very quickly put an end to this experiment in Native American higher education, or rather, I should say, put it to sleep, because it is reviving today. And you know, a sizable number of Wampanoags are attending university, including Harvard.
And an early death, not that unusual at this time. I mean, obviously with disease and just longevity.
Most colonial leaders had a vision that Native people would fall under colonial rule and aspire to colonial standards of civility and Christianity. These are utopian hopes, right? And those utopian hopes are captured by the Thanksgiving myth. They sanitized this really bloody history. And when Native people pushed back, as they invariably did, these utopian dreams of Native people living subjugated to English authority could very often degenerate into genocidal impulses.
Let me get some callers. We got Lisa calling us from Phoenixville. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there, Lisa.
Yes, hi. Thanks for – how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I've been a school board member for 4 years, and my term is just finishing. But I wanted to call and say that I think if we really want to change the nature of how Americans look at this history, we have to change how we teach it in school, and that includes a whole new curriculum and the way and the pedagogy behind how we teach it, and also the tone. We teach a very Americanized version of, you know, American superiority in this instance, and I think it really harms us all.
Well, I appreciate that. The call to Radio Times. You teach young people.
I do.
Do you think schools are not doing enough to really tell this true story?
Oh, nowhere close. Look, one of the reasons that this myth has stayed with us for so long is this practice of having grade schoolers perform Thanksgiving pageants.
Dressing up, right?
They dress up as Plains Indians and pilgrims with oversized buckles on every conceivable article of clothing to launch the United States out of.
I remember doing that as a kid, but this is happening now as well.
It continues to this very day. One of the reasons I wrote this book was that teachers, secondary school teachers, have repeatedly told me that they all teach the so-called history of this first Thanksgiving each November, but feel utterly ill-equipped to do so, you know, that they don't have the content knowledge to teach it with the level of detail and sophistication that it deserves. And no wonder. Native people appear in most American school curriculums, if at all, only in the month of November, and then drop out of American history altogether. And no wonder, right? Taking Native American history turns American patriotic themes inside out. And it turns heroes sometimes into villains, or at least deeply flawed heroes. And most white Americans think the purpose of a history education is to make young people feel patriotic. Well, that's not the purpose of a history education. It's designed to allow us to look critically at our past so we can think critically about our future. And I think there would be no exercise that would be no more valuable in helping us to achieve those goals than to reinsert, or rather insert for the first time, Native American history in the American history curriculum. But it's going to require school boards to create standardized tests that will incentivize teachers on the front lines to teach that material and to teach it right.
That seems very complicated.
It's a political matter.
And it's very much a political matter.
That's right. And it's going to require parents insisting that this history be told.
I'm thinking then, going back to, let's say, second grade, they're going to celebrate Thanksgiving. How would you suggest they celebrate what really happened back then in 16? 16-
I'm not sure the true history is appropriate for kids in second grade. Look, there's no reason why we have to attach a false history to this holiday. During the colonial era, colonists celebrated Thanksgiving with no reference whatsoever to this myth of pilgrims and Indians. It's a late 19th century invention. And so, you know, if the holiday existed for so long without this myth attached to it, we can detach it and introduce students to this history when they're more mature and ready for it.
A couple of comments. Paul says, can Thanksgiving evolve like everything? There have been many wrongs throughout history that have been rectified. I mean, it seems that this is what grown-ups do. I mean, grown-ups are able to look at our past and put things into a factual and historical context.
I'm not sure we can right the wrongs of this history. Native people are still fighting for their sovereignty and their land and their cultural autonomy. And they're never going to live their lives now as they would have created it were it not for this colonial history. But we can do better. And one of the ways we can do better is by not making light of their traumatic history, by having our grade schoolers create decorations of happy Indians and pilgrims and decorating our houses with those themes and holding Thanksgiving pageants. We can make a positive change by recognizing that Native American history isn't separate from American history. Native American men and women are country people. And a national holiday shouldn't make light of their traumas. National holidays, natural rituals should bring us together, not divide us. And Native people are here to stay. They've passed through the historical apocalypse. They're not going anywhere. We need to start recognizing that they're a constituent part of the American fabric.
And as you say, and as they say, the Wampanoag about themselves, that for them, this is a day of mourning. I mean, this is a day where they commemorate the loss of something. They grieve over the loss of something.
Yeah, some of them recognize the holiday that way, and they have a lot to mourn. Look, anywhere your listeners are, they're on native land. Let's start with that basic premise. And so if you're a native person driving, walking, looking out your back door, every day is a reminder of how much has been lost.
A question from George. Have the Wampanoag reclaimed their spiritual traditions? Are they still Christians, for instance?
They have a range of religious beliefs and practices like any other dynamic community.
And as you mentioned, there are two, recognized tribal lands, Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, which is on Cape Cod.
Correct.
And then the Wampanoag Tribe of Gay Head, which is Martha's Vineyard.
Or Aquinnah, yes, right on Martha's Vineyard. They're both federally recognized tribes. Until recently, both of them had reservations, land held in trust by the federal government. Trump's Department of the Interior has recently taken Mashpee's land out of trust and thrown that community into chaos.
Meaning they could lose their land?
Meaning they could lose their land after some of it was restored to them after their federal recognition in 2007.
Mashpee, I'm just trying to think. Mashpee's on Cape Cod.
That is correct.
Is it considered valuable land?
Yeah, and it's especially valuable to them, not because of its monetary worth, but because their ancestors are buried thousands of generations deep there.
And if anyone is familiar with Massachusetts or even New England, there are so many Wampanoag words. I mean, Nauset. There's, Nauset Beach on Cape Cod. There's the Monomoy Island. That's a Wampanoag word. It goes on and on. Mashpee.
Massachusetts is an Algonquian language word. Connecticut is an Algonquian language word. They're all over that region.
Let me get Shelley. Looks like Shelley is calling us from Philadelphia. And Shelley, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I really appreciate this conversation. And
thanks.
Also, I thought to mention that it's not just about the schools changing their curriculum, which I think needs to be done and be important, but it's about parents having conversations with their children. Like, I wasn't happy with what my children were coming home knowing about Thanksgiving, and we went to the library, and we took out books on Native Americans and their history, and that's our discussion going on at home right now.
Well,
and I think lot of what we complain about, parents have to take action.
I think that that's a really good point, Jill. You want to respond to that?
I concede the point.
Beverly says she's ordered your book. Does she have any suggestions for her grandkids, children, and youth? I mean, I certainly think what Shelley just said is something everyone can do, which is educate ourselves.
Right. So if you go to the Plymouth Plantation website, they have resources for educators of young children. And those educators could, as your previous caller said, easily be parents. So I would encourage if your listeners, if any of them want to, start educating their own children on the subject, to go to the Plymouth Plantation website and use their resources.
I'm curious about what some of the Wampanoag think about your book.
I was worried about that. This book originated with conversations I had with Wampanoag people. And at every stage of the research, I consulted with historically minded Wampanoag people willing to work with me. But the question was what the wider community would think. So far, the results have been really gratifying. I gave a talk out at Falmouth on Cape Cod, and a number of Wampanoag people came by and said thank you for, you know, sharing what they consider to be an accurate representation of their history and modern perspectives with a wider audience.
Has anyone raised the question about you being not Wampanoag but being a white man, for instance?
Right. That's always an issue. And I think there's an irreconcilable tension within many Native communities that they would prefer to tell their own history themselves, but they also want the wider American public to take Native American history seriously within the context of a greater American history. And that requires non-Native historians to participate in this telling. I think it's also important to note that there's a value in having someone from outside the group tell this history. All groups are defensive about the reputations of their ancestors. That applies to Wampanoags or anybody else around the globe. And you know, a historian's job is not to make people in the present feel good about the way their ancestors behaved, but to capture a complex history in all of its complexity.
Do you think, though, that we are, as a country, sort of moving towards some kind of reconciliation or even understanding of our past?
I think
are we making progress on this front?
Yeah, I think half the country is. I think the other half of the country would see a history of this sort as trying to tear the country down, as opposed to what my real goal is, which is to have us engage in truth-telling about ourselves and where we came from.
And the idea – I mean, there is this idea that if you tell the history and you shed light on things that we would rather not know, that there's something unpatriotic about that.
I don't think there's anything unpatriotic about it at all. And here's the spin I would put on it. Native people are our country people, right? And so if we're propagating a history that is both untrue and hurtful to them, where's the patriotism in that?
Leaving that out there for us to think about.
Right.
Well, on that note, we're going to end our conversation. David Silverman, thanks so much. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for writing the book as well.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And the book is called This Land Is Their Land, and it's subtitled The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving. And our guest is a professor of history at George Washington University, where he specializes in Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.